the best things in life for free. If you subscribe to The Spectator, you'll get a whole month for free. And after that, you'll only pay £1 for full access to our website and to our app. And if you want to pay £2, you'll get our magazine too. To claim this offer, go to spectator.co.uk/free.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, The Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Olivia Potts, and today we're delighted to be joined by Ewan Venters, the former chief executive of Fortnum & Mason and now the CEO of Artfam and Hauser & Wirth. Ewan is launching Artfam's first London venture combining food, drink and art, and very shortly it will be the revival of the historic Mayfair landmark, the Audley. Ewan, welcome to Table Talk.
Hello.
So, Ewan, we'll start where we always do, at the very beginning, and ask you, what are your earliest memories of food?
I think I have two clear memories, actually. You know, I was born in Scotland, as you know. I grew up a lot of time with my grandmother in a fishing village called Pittenweem on the east nook, the east coast of Fife. And there were sort of two very strong, evocative memories of food. And one was going down to the harbour and seeing the boats coming in and the fishermen sort of throwing my brother and I a few fish for us to take back up to my grandmother's kitchen. And I seem to remember, you know, a lot of flatfish, you know, lemon sole being carried up and watching my grandmother fillet fish and cook delicious things with it. That was one strong memory. And then the other was making marmalade. You know, the Scots are very famous for their, not for their oranges, but for marmalade making, several oranges. And I can tell you now, I can smell it. I can see her, I can see the stove, the pot, and I've got the smell in my nostrils now. It's amazing just how, you know, 45 years from when I was first watching her make marmalade, it's as strong today as it was then.
And is that something you've inherited? Do you make your own marmalade now?
No, not so much. I mean, lots of family and friends, funny enough, do make. I mean, I live in London mostly, and even my London neighbours make marmalades, you know. So, no, I don't need to make marmalade so much myself, but I do love baking and I do love cooking. So, you know, that's certainly stuck with me all my years. Great. I don't know how good I am, but I love it.
And was that something that she involve you in, or were you a mere spectator? What was your role in your grandmother's kitchen?
Oh, I think there was no chance to be a spectator. I mean, my brother and I were always, you know, involved in some capacity, you know, whether it was washing pots or cleaning up or actually helping her. So no, there was no time for being a spectator. It was very much hands-on, even at the sort of tender age of, you know, 5, 6, 7. But we were keen, you know, we were keen as mustard. And in fact, we would sometimes come up from the harbour with, you know, hands full of fish and then head back down again and see if we could chance a luck the second time. And so I think sometimes I think we really were feeding, you know, quite a lot of people with the quantities of fish that would come. But great, you know, great memories, great, really fond childhood memories of food in that context.
And the mealtimes that you had together as a family, were they important? Were they rushed? What were they like? What was it like sitting down together as a family?
Yeah, I think I always we were brought up in a, you know, where, you know, eating, we called it tea in Scotland, you know, it was like tea time. So you would have your tea at 5:30 or 6 o'clock or something. And yeah, every conceivable opportunity, we would all eat together. I'm sure it wasn't some idyllic picture postcard of, you know, grand dinners that lasted hours. I'm sure it was a bit faster than that in reality. But no, people weren't in a rush. I mean, you know, if the weather was great, I suppose we were all dead keen to get out and go walking and on the beach and so on. But it was a happy time. I have strong leisurely breakfast memories, you know, Sunday, going to church on a Sunday and, you know, coming back. I was brought up as a Catholic and my mother was Catholic and we'd go to church and then come back. And my father wasn't particularly religious at all. So he would have the duty of making sure that there was a fantastic cooked breakfast ready for when we would return. And that was always a great occasion, you know, for an hour or 2 hours where we would all sit and chat and feast and read the newspapers and, you know, talk about what was going on in everybody's life. And so Sunday lunches, Sunday sort of late breakfast, early lunch was a kind of a strong childhood memory.
And what about school food? Were they happy memories?
Yeah, I don't see. Yes, I think they were fine. I don't particularly. I mean, look, I've been an entrepreneur all my life, and when, from the age of about 7 or 8, I was, you know, running the school tuck shop, you know, the illegal tuck shop in the school ground. So I don't think I probably stood around for lunch much, because I was always, there was always something on my mind about how I could sell some stuff and sell chocolate bars, et cetera, et cetera. So no, but actually I think school food, you know, I was part of a generation that we did get free school milk, and we had proper dinner ladies who actually could cook. And so I have pretty good memories of school food being shepherd's pie. Yeah, it'd been great. You know, things like that that were genuinely homemade. So, and I get quite cross and quite angry now when I see the challenges of food in institutions generally, but, you know, in state-run schools, where you go, you know, there's no need for it to be that bad. You know, it can be better. You know, and I always admire people like Henry Dimbleby and, you know, others who have shown, Jamie, obviously, very famously, you know, shown that there are ways of putting skills back into kitchens and getting raw ingredients into kitchens and actually providing not just better food, but actually food that's often produced at far less cost than buying in fully processed sugar and salt laden processed foods.
And speaking of your early entrepreneurship, am I right in thinking you made your own tablet?
Well, I wondered, Olivia, you're well researched. I mean, absolutely. Oh, no. This story has never, never been told before. Yeah, you bet. I mean, I started a little bakery business when I was 11, delivering bread rolls to the local neighborhood. And they were, largely speaking, those bread rolls and other bakery goods I was buying in from a local baker. You know, I had a contract with them and they would deliver to my parents' house. And then I would do the onwards distribution of said rolls to Scottish rolls. That's a proper Scottish word. Like for other audiences that don't reside in Scotland, you know, morning baps, morning roll, you know, morning, yeah, buns. I mean, different parts of the United Kingdom call them different things. But yeah, so I did that. And then I thought, oh, tablet. Again, a tablet was something that I think my mother made more than my grandmother. And I took to making Scottish tablet, which, as you well know, is a bit like fudge, but a firmer texture.
A bit more brittle, isn't it?
A bit more brittle, but not too brittle, you know, a bit more brittle. And I would make, I think, probably the best tablet in Fife, without question. And it would sell ever so well. And I managed to perfect the art of having three pots on the cooker top at the same time, but setting them 15 minutes apart, so that at every stage of the process, I could up my production, but never burn the tablet or overcook the tablet.
And I mean, that is sincerely very impressive. Anyone who's made fudge knows how fiercely it spits and boils and how quickly it can go.
And then how you beat it. I was taught that one of the best ways is to, of course, cool the tablet mixture down fast. So I learned that you had to fill a basin of cold water, add ice cubes to make it really cold, so that when you took it off the stove and you put the pan into the cold water and beat it, and that was the way of, if you like, speeding up production, but also protecting and getting that the fudge not to, or the tablet, not to be too much like fudge and not to be too much like toffee, but to be tablet. And I'm very proud because all these years later, when I was running Fortnum's, one of my great long-term mates, Tom Parker Bowles, you know, wrote the very first Fortnum's cookbook. And I was invited to contribute to the book with my own recipe. And I put in Ewan's tablet. Yeah. And so Ewan's tablet lives on as a formal recipe in the Fortnum's cookbook. And then the buyers thought it was so good that the buying department have converted it into a factory-made product. And so if you go into Fortnum's today, you'll actually see a box of Ewan's tablet, and it's got my signature on it. So perhaps that will sit on the, well, hopefully not sit on the shelves, but hopefully sell from the shelves.
The shelves.
For many, many decades to come. Well, it's very interesting because I travel through Heathrow an awful lot of my job now, and at the Fortnum's shop there, I often go in to buy a box of the tablet to take with me as a gift to whoever I'm going to see in the world. And they're forever running out. So the staff say that Scottish tablets are a big seller. So Ewan's tablet is out there in the world.
I was going to say that's so handy if you're going through Heathrow and can just pick up a personalised gift. But if it's not reliably there, if it's too popular.
Absolutely. Yeah. Fortnum's management, note to action, up the production.
Please check your stock levels on tablet. So how did you end up in London? Where did you go straight from Fife to London?
No, I did, because my folks, you know, would bring my brother and I to London every year, once, twice a year, to the theatre, to galleries, to museums, to the great shops of London from a very young age. So mm-hmm. I was incredibly at ease with London. You know, I felt that London was a second home, if you like. My father had sailed in and out of the East End of London when he was in the Merchant Navy. My mother was in the medical service, and she worked in at Great Ormond Street Hospital, amongst others. So they loved London. London was a big passion for them. So, of course, when it came to doing my Scottish Highers, which are a bit like A-levels, there was a decision to be made. You know, did I go on to college or university in Scotland, or did I get into the workplace? And my mother read a whole article about the management training program at Sainsbury's, at the supermarket Sainsbury's, which I make that distinction because there was no Sainsbury's in Scotland. You know, this was an English company that was only south of the border, had never made it to Scotland. So in itself, that was all kind of exciting and quite exotic in a way, this idea of this amazing supermarket. And of course, back in, you know, we're talking about the late 80s at this point, you know, Sainsbury were the undisputed sort of number one. They were the champions of the supermarket sector, and they had some of the best produce and the best suppliers and some of the best ingredients. And so I applied to Heriot Watt, the university, at the same time as applying to Sainsbury's. And it just caught my imagination. And I realized that they were an extraordinary professional organization with a super structured training program. And they offered me a job in London. And I thought, I'm off. And so 16, just turning 17, with four or five hires to my name, I headed to London to join August the 21st, I think it was. August 21st, 1989, is when I headed and arrived in London. And have
so
sort
just
of...
just passed the anniversary of it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's sort of never left since. You know, not really. I mean, I had a little bit of time in Yorkshire for a year or two, but broadly speaking, I have lived in London ever since.
And as you say, you visited a lot, but what was it like arriving? I mean, 16 or 17 is young to kind of really fly the nest and move to a completely different city. What was it like arriving in London at that point for you?
Well, you know, you started this interview talking about, you know, early food memories, and I sort of talked about smell. So smell, arriving on the train into King's Cross, the smell of diesel. You know, there weren't many electric trains around at that point, you know, and nor were there coal trains, steam trains, so it was diesel. And so I remember that mugginess, that warm, London was warm. London summers always seemed to be hotter than perhaps they appear to be today. But I wonder if that's just getting older, that these memories change. But it was a muggy, hot, it was a week or two before I officially started. I had a lot of cousins. A lot of my cousins lived in London. So the transition was not as tough because I was coming to a city that I knew a bit about. I was familiar with the transport. I had a number of cousins who had homes in London. So I headed actually to Dulwich initially to stay with my eldest cousin, who was a diplomat in the Foreign Office. And I resided with her for some time before I ended up in my own accommodation once I settled. So it was tough. And I think, gosh, 16 turning 17, so young, but there was a good network and there was a family network, which made it easier.
And you went from Sainsbury's to Selfridges. Presumably at that point you had made the decision that this kind of buying career was for you, that you'd found your métier, so to speak.
Well, there was actually a step in between. So Sainsbury's, there was Sainsbury's, largely speaking, for about 9 years of my career, which incidentally included an extraordinary period as the citrus buyer, being responsible for
marmalade.
They're back to the marmalade. Yeah, there we go. I was destined to be, and you know, that was incredible to be responsible for all the clementines and the satsumas and the oranges and limes and lemons, etc. For Sainsbury's, and that was extraordinary. But no, I was tempted away to go and join a food distribution business, which was family owned, called Brake Brothers. And Breaks were this sort of hidden giant of an organization based down in outside Ashford in Kent, started by three brothers from a pub, and they were supplying many extraordinary establishments with frozen food, vegetables, fresh fish to grocery products. And I was one of the very first non-family members to join the main board, aged 26, of Breaks. And that was the transition period, still very much in food, very much in sourcing, but then started to broaden my experience into more general management, sales management, logistics, and so on. And then the Weston family, the Canadian side of the Weston family, bought Selfridges in 2003, 2004. And they came knocking on my door saying, look, we think you would be interesting to join the board because you have this retail experience with Sainsbury's, but then you've got this restaurant food service experience through the Breaks supply chain. And during that period of working for Breaks is where I forged a lot of my great friendships with Angela Hartnett, with Marco Pierre-White, with Gordon, with Mark Hicks, with Chris Galvin, with Michelle Root. They were all relationships that I developed, ironically, whilst working for Breaks, because we were such a diverse business doing supplies of truffles and supplies of rare meats and supplies of fresh produce. It was such a diverse organization that there probably was barely a restaurant in the land that somehow didn't interact with this extraordinary private business that had become this sort of giant, if you like, in the British, a hidden giant, really, because, you know, nobody knows who Breaks are. You know, I mean, really, I mean, it's not a consumer-facing brand, but a very important business. And that led nicely to me joining the board at Selfridges.
And when you moved to Fortnum & Mason in 2012, I think that I'm going to try and get the statistics right, that you grew profits from, is it 1 million to 12 million in 7 years?
Well,
does that sound about right?
Yeah, I mean, on the toughest measure of all, profit before tax, it'd actually been a loss-making business for the 7 years before 2012. I mean, I think I'd lost 30 plus million over those years. The very first year I took the reins at Fordham's, we got to 1 million of profit. So, you know, it probably the year before it had made a loss or break even or something. So we got it to 1 million. And then very quickly over those 7 years, yeah, we were up to 12 million of profit before tax. And, but, you know, what an extraordinary team. I mean, it was, you know, I happened to be the CEO, but I mean, it was an extraordinary team of people that helped make that happened. We were also, you know, when one looks back, we were also, you know, we were lucky in a way. I think the Olympic summer was such a strong moment for the country, but such a strong moment for London, obviously. You know, when one thinks back to 2012, summer of 2012, I mean, Britain was in an extremely prosperous place. It was doing well. It had a great standing in the world. The world was looking at it. You know, when you think about the challenges today in our society, in a very short period of time, we've got a whole host of different types of challenges that back in 2012, it felt like we could have, you know, the country could achieve anything. So I think that taking on the Fortnum & Mason business in 2012 on the back of the Olympic summer, I think was a great stepping stone. You know, it was a great springboard to help drive Fortnum's in a way and to make it more relevant. That was the big thing, make it more relevant to more people more often. And that was the simple.
And how did you do that? I mean, it obviously has this incredible reputation, but its reputation is pinned on the fact that much of the food is luxury food or, you know, luxury brands. How do you go about making that relevant?
But there you go. There was the very point, is that the number one volume item in Fortnum & Mason is tea. And there is nothing more humble than a great cup of tea. And I just was relentless in my communications style and marketing pursuit to say to everyone who cared to listen that if you care about that one of the most important drinks of the day, if that is a cup of tea, then why wouldn't you want to drink the best possible tea? And if you are going to visit a friend and you've got a certain budget and you understand what type of tea they enjoy, then actually spending £12 10 pounds, £12, on a great tin of tea that's been thoughtfully, you know, the flavour, you've thought about the flavour, you've thought about what the person you're going to see would like. Isn't that great value, suddenly?
Mm. And it's also a thing of beauty. I mean, that's the other thing about the packaging, way
Portland's arranging their work. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, way before it became fashionable to talk about upcycling, you know, people held on to beautiful tins. Yes. They used them for their buttons, for their penny pieces, for their trinkets, you know. And so it was deeply, you know, we were talking about that before it became a sort of fashionable thing to talk about, not just recycling, but upcycling, because that was what Fortnum's packaging was all about. So really being more relevant to more people more often, you know, the second most popular drink in the world after water is tea.
So it's just about reframing how you think about it.
And it was about reframing that and realizing actually, you know, most people were able to engage with the brand irrespective of your budget when it came to being able to buy tea. And now, I mean, one of the last projects I was involved in before I left was creating a tea blending station so that you can actually blend your own tea and you can have a bespoke label for your friends, for your name or your friend's name or whatever. And that can be registered in a database and then you can reorder it online and make that whole, elevate that whole experience to become a very personal thing. And as I understand it, that continues to this day and I think is very successful.
And while you were there, you launched the Fortnum & Mason Food and Drink Awards, which have become sort of icon in the food and drink world.
I think I'm talking to an award winner, am I not?
I mean, I think it's far from me to say, but I do hear the judges have excellent taste. They have mediocre taste in the years I'm shortlisted. Excellent taste in the year I win. How did that change the way people interacted with Fortnum's and with you? Because it has become sort of bigger than itself almost.
Well, it was the idea was very simple. I had been a judge at the Glenfiddich Awards. And, you know, for those who are a bit of my vintage and older will remember the Glenfiddichs fondly, the whisky company who had a vision at some point to want to recognise excellence in the world of broadcasting, writing around the subject of food and drink. But at some point, the sponsors, the Grant family, decided to call time on the Glenfiddichs. And so I Lindsay Stewart, who we all know very well in the food world, was really one of the anchor people at managing the Glenfiddich award process. So Lindsay and I had lunch on a number of occasions and said, wouldn't it be great to resurrect the Glenfiddichs? And then I arrive in Fortnum's August 2012. We have lunch within the first week or two. And I said, this is the moment, Lindsay. We should resurrect the Glenfiddichs. And then between us, we both went, but why on earth would we resurrect the Glenfiddichs? Why wouldn't we call it the Fortnum & Mason Food and Drink Awards? Mm. After all, Fortnum's has been in the food business for well over 300 years. So I think has a right and a respect and a status by which its brand name, it can be associated with excellence. And so we took the model of the Glenfiddich Awards, independent judges each year. I would chair the meeting, but I would not have a vote. So it wasn't about the company deciding who should win. It was about these six strongly minded independent judges from the food and drink world, who each year would go through the process of reviewing the nominations. And now it must be, I think, fast approaching its 12th year. So, you know, isn't that fantastic? But it was also just a great way of engaging the community. You know, we're all in a community, food and drink, but in this food and drink community. And actually everybody in the community wanted an excuse to come together, wanted an excuse to come and, you know, break bread and share great experiences and scrutinize and challenge what people were doing in broadcasting and in writing, and to celebrate those people who were doing it extremely well. And it is a lasting legacy. I can see absolutely no reason why it still won't be going in 20 or 30 or 40 years' time. You know, look at some of the great prizes of the world, from, you know, the Booker Prize to the Turner Prize to, you know, music industry prizes. You know, many of them have been going for decades and decades. And I think the Fortnum & Mason Food & Drink Awards will continue. I was very proud, as I was leaving, my then chairman, Kate Hophouse, said, you know, what next for the wards here? What do you think we should do when you leave? And I said, but look, you know, one of the most adorable chefs who everybody loves, who everybody adores, has not a bad word to say, is, of course, Angela Hartnett. Mm-hmm. And I said, why don't you ask Angela, who had been a great friend to me, but a great friend to Fortnum's, why don't you ask Angela to become the new chair of the process? And that's what they've done, and I think that's been a smart decision, and I think absolutely. Angela helps keep it with Fortnum support clearly and the team there, but I think Angela helps give it another level of glamour and status, and I'm deeply proud that it continues.
Rightly so. Tell us about your newest venture, because what you've been able to do is combine your twin loves of food and drink, which we've talked about, and art, which we haven't really touched on yet. But that's been a long-standing passion of yours, is that right?
Very much so. I mean, as I started the interview talking about my early trips to London, to galleries, to museums, you know, we grew up just not in a high church of art, but just in a world where we appreciated that art was a very important part of living and of learning and of sharing. And of course, we all know some of the great artists of the world, you know, would spend some of their a great deal of their time in restaurants and loved food, and they do. I mean, the artists that I work with today, I don't know a single artist who doesn't love the engagement of food and drink, whether it's cooked in a domestic home or whether it's going out to a restaurant. So there was this sort of natural DNA in me of loving art. And so when this opportunity arose to join an organization that is, you know, principally grown out of a contemporary art gallery, now many galleries around the world, but with a deep interest and love of agriculture, of farming, of food, of wine, of that celebration of great produce alongside wonderful art, hence the company Art Farm was born, and a deep privilege and an opportunity to express my passion for food, but my passion for art in that combined way. And, you know, we're just at the beginning, really, of the story, in a way. I mean, we have a number of very interesting projects in the United Kingdom, in Los Angeles, next year in New York, and I'm sure, you know, further afield in due course. But it's a real genuine privilege to be able to lead a business and help shape it around the wonderful interests of art, food, and wine.
And how have you gone about setting up the Audley as a space for those combinations?
Well, I mean, firstly, as I've alluded to, it's a team, teamwork, you know, extraordinary teamwork. But, you know, we had the vision to say, we love the architecture of the building, we love the Audley building, and that was the number one thing. That the building had great history and heritage. It opened in the 1880s as a public house, as a restaurant on the first floor, and in fact as a hotel in the upper floors. And so it had a deep historical reference. It's also located on that corner of Mount Street and South Audley Street, where once upon a time was very much the centre of the art world in London. A lot of the historical dealers were in this part of Mayfair. They subsequently moved a bit further east to Piccadilly and to Cork Street, and so, and then they moved, some of them moved even further east into the East End. So there was a number of, I think, you know, authentic DNA roots that were telling us that this building, this location in Mayfair, its proximity to the London Gallery in Savile Row, just being a 6 or 7 minute walk away, felt like a great decision. Then we get into the detail, and our obligation was to retain and restore the pub, the public house on the ground floor anyway. But of course, in the heart of any community, that a great pub is often a very important part of a community. So that was a privilege to recognise that actually we should restore the pub and make it more special and more important in the community. And then the plan developed to convert the first floor into what is known as the Mount Street restaurant, and then to take the upper floors, which were, as I said, hotel rooms, there were bedrooms. And by the time we took on the building, those rooms were actually staff accommodation, so they were not glamorous. But and we came up with this idea of, well, let's call them the curious rooms, interesting rooms that you can have conversations in, that you can have a celebratory breakfast, have a lunch, have a special dinner. And then thinking through art and the role of art, and that's where, of course, I'm surrounded by experts in Hauser and Wirth, that of people who have a deep passion and a deep understanding of art. And that's where the team comes in, and you assemble some great food people, and you assemble some great art people, and then the magic happens. And that's what we have today.
And how have you gone about designing the menu for the restaurant itself? Has that been something you've had input on?
Oh, completely. No, I mean, we didn't have the chef from the earliest days. So, you know, Jamie Shears, who's the executive chef, arrived a bit closer to the opening. So the thinking had to be done well in advance. And that's when we, two or three of us and a few friends in the trade, all sat down and thought through, well, we didn't want it to just be another Mayfair restaurant selling sashimi and buffalo mozzarella and avocados. By the way, you'll never find an avocado in any of our menus because they're so hungry on water. You know, they're killing the planet in a different way. So we're avocado free, and we're salmon free as well, because we don't believe in farmed salmon and the devastation it's having on the riverbed. So we're principled on a couple of key points on food ingredients, but maybe that's another subject. But no, so we thought through, well, what's the history of London food? When this pub and restaurant opened in 1880, you know, what would have been available? And that's when you start thinking, well, actually shellfish, oysters, lobsters, eel, you know, from the River Thames, blancmange, the Chelsea bun, you know, the history of the Chelsea bun, the bun bakery in Chelsea. And well, what was it? The spices and the, you know. So you then start to work through breaking those stories down. Mm. Pie and mash, a very ordinary item. So the lobster pie, which is the kind of the most Instagrammable dish you see from this restaurant by our clients, by our patrons, is the lobster pie. And of course, it's pie and mash, basically. But lobsters, because they were very cheap, they weren't seen as the luxury food that they are today. And so that was the genesis of how we took a simple London pie and mash story, took the lobster ingredient that was prevalent back then and created this fantastic dish that tastes delicious but looks great. And that's how the menu and how the genesis of the menu has developed. And that's in the Mount Street restaurant. And then you look at the pub and you go, well, we've got cockles on the menu, and we have fantastic, obvious classics like, you know, fish and chips. And then we're lucky that down in Somerset, where we have a gallery in Bruton, it's located on our own farm. And so we have access on our own farm to fantastic beef, fantastic lamb. So we'll use the beef, the lamb from the farm to inform many of the dishes. And of course, carcass utilization is hugely important. So the chefs have got to be constantly creative to make sure that we're not just using prime cuts, but that we're using really the nose to tail and creating dishes that utilizes the entire carcass. And that's a really strong, if like, ethos and premise of what we do. And in the pub, it's accessible. I mean, you can literally just go and order one sausage, two sausages, three sausages. I mean, it's just per sausage and a pot of mustard and a pint of beer. And, you know, you have a very delicious, wholesome, healthy, affordable lunch.
And when you're eating out, but not in one of your places, where do you like to eat in London?
Well, I'm...
Or not just in London. It doesn't have to be London.
The
whole world. Exactly. Where do you like to eat, Ian?
Where I like to eat all. Look, I think we all have... I would say that we have favourites of where we love to eat because of our memories of certain dishes. I guess when you're lucky enough to eat out quite a lot, I think that's what drives my, you know, decision-making about, you know, where I might want to go. And I think that bears quite a sort of strong influence. So, you know, for sure in London, you know, I'm a great fan of the River Cafe, for sure. And there's always, you know, the panna cotta is something that's adorable, or just when you're on the spot, you start to think, oh, what is that like? But, you know, their mozzarella is actually pretty fantastic because it's flown in twice a week and it comes with, you know, or their, you know, the white peaches in the season with the ham. Mm. Or, you know, Angela, talked about Angela, but Murano, Cafe Murano, you know, has the most delicious in the autumn ossobuco with risotto milanese. You know, that's just divine thing to go and have, you know, and that's a great thing. So I suppose really, you know, I've just been in Cornwall and went to the Mariners, to Paul Ainsworth's place, because I know that he does this extraordinary starter that's a chicken, sort of a deep fried chicken that's got some delicious sauce. And yeah, so it's just, you know, and that's on the menu every summer. So whenever I'm in Cornwall, that's a big trip to go and to have that chicken dish. So I think we're a bit like that, really, you know. Mark Hicks with his Sussex Pond pudding, you know, down in his Dorset restaurant in the right season, you know, that would be something that I would drive out of my way for, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
And to finish, we ask all our guests the same question, which is, what would your desert island meal be? It can be as complicated or as simple as you like, but what would be your ultimate meal?
Well, if it was in the right season, I would have white truffle risotto. Mm. Quite simple to do. Could do that on a desert island, just a bit of heat. Pan. It's a one pan dish, isn't it? That's a good thing. If I had a bit more cooking facilities, then I guess lobster and chips with homemade mayonnaise has to be one of those sort of iconic. And then I have a fond love of lemon posset. Delia Smith's lemon posset recipe.
My husband's favourite.
So I reckon I could probably do white truffle starter, lobster and chips as my main, and lemon posset for my pudding. So I think that's a pretty good combination.
And if we were going to somehow provide you with accompanying drink of some description, what would you have?
Oh, I think a proper ale. We underestimate the power of a good ale with food. Mm. I think we all jump to fine wines and... which is, of course, fantastic. But I think a great beer, a light ale, or indeed a proper dark beer, you know, with food, can often be really rather rewarding. And I think on the desert island, you'd need something a bit more substantive than just a glass of wine.
Something thirst quenching.
Yes. So I think a good ale with that delicious Last Supper. And then to finish, a cup of Fortnum's tea. Preferably Royal Blend.
Ah, ideal. Ian, it has been a complete pleasure to have you on Table Talk. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink Podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.